Good afternoon, everybody. It's a new week of Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Paige Murray-Bessler, in for Cherry Gregg.
You sure are.
It's really great to be sitting next to you, Avi, for this program.
You know what's funny? People don't know this. You and I, we sit next to each other like our desks are adjacent.
Yeah, it's annoying.
And we have a lot of conversations, sometimes some disagreements. Yeah. So today, maybe we're going to bring that energy onto the airwaves. But they're fun disagreements that you and I have.
Are they?
Yes.
Usually. For me, they're. Okay. For me, they are. They're maybe more fun for, okay. for you than they are for me because I'm usually right. But
so this is producer Paige Murray-Bessler filling in for Cherry today. And you actually, it's great that you're here. Because you produced today's show.
So I did.
Tell folks what it's about.
So I love this topic because I have a baby.
You're a new mom.
And I could talk about him for the whole hour, but I'm not going to. It's really hard to not talk about your kids once you have them. But we're going to get personal because the birth rate is declining.
It is.
You know, not just in this country, but all over the world. And so we kind of just wanted to talk about why. Why people are having not just, you know, fewer kids, but no kids at all.
Yep.
And, you know, we're a listener-involved show, so we got to get our listeners involved in this. Getting pretty personal, like I said, we want to hear about you, listener, your decision to have kids or not have kids, what it's meant for your life, mm-hmm. how you weighed that decision. Maybe you're not at childbearing age yet and you're sort of thinking about what you'll do
right.
when you reach that age. Maybe you're older and you just decided that it wasn't right for your life. We want to know why you made that decision and just sort of how it played out for you.
Exactly. So give us a call, 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. And I confess, when we decided that this was the question we were going to ask, I thought, I don't know if people are really going to share. But I'm already looking at a huge bank of emails, and they're unbelievable. And first of all, just thank you to everyone who's already written in,
yeah.
who's shared their personal perspective on this very personal decision. We also have a couple of great experts with us that Paige booked for the show.
I booked them. What can I say?
they're great. They are awesome. And so we're going to have them in the second and third segments of the show today. But first, Paige, as you know, we always start with a trio of local news stories. And we want to start with some good news.
Okay.
Out of Philadelphia. We have talked before in the show about how there are fewer homicides this year in Philadelphia than there had been, especially during the early years of the pandemic.
Right.
And this past month, September, saw the fewest number of homicides in the city of Philadelphia in nearly a decade. This stat brought to our attention by the Philadelphia Inquirer. In the month of September, Paige, only 10 killings in the city of Philadelphia. And I know it's hard to put that word only in front of 10 people losing their lives. But when you compare it to the height of the pandemic, we had months where that number was north of 60.
Right.
So it's dramatically come down. Another interesting thing, Paige, within this story that the Inquirer did about this nearly unprecedented number,
mm-hmm.
they noted that the homicide clearance rate in Philadelphia is over 70%, according to Police Chief Kevin Bethel.
Wait, can we remind people what the clearance rate is?
So the clearance rate, it's like a shorthand number for basically how many murders you solve.
Right.
And that number had been below 50% in 2022. Now, according to the police chief, above 70%. And that's key for many reasons. One, you want people to actually be deterred from doing crimes.
Right.
And if there's more certainty around being arrested, that helps. But a lot of criminology shows that a relatively small number of people are participating in and are victims of homicides in a city like Philadelphia. And if you're able to charge those people with crimes, you can interrupt the cycle of violence. And so that's a really really hopeful number, at least from where I sit. Imagine that. It used to be that if you committed a murder in Philadelphia, the chances of you being charged were less than a coin flip.
That's true. And then we had a bunch of repeat offenders.
Exactly.
A cycle that continues of victims being perpetrators
yep.
becoming victims. So, I mean, the number 10, like you said, it's hard to say only.
Yes.
But that is pretty shocking for the city of Philadelphia.
It sure is. Now, there is a bit of a cloud hanging over all of this.
Okay.
Because we are watching a developing story right now that involves a homicide detective in the city of Philadelphia. His name is Christopher Sweeney, and on Thursday evening in Northeast Philadelphia, while he was off duty, he shot and killed a man named Robert Jones. There is a lot of uncertainty about exactly what happened, but we know that they were at a traffic light, these two men, Sweeney and Jones, that Jones exited his car, that Sweeney shot and killed him, including shooting through the window of his car. There is a lot, again, we don't know, and we don't want to speculate too much about what happened between this off-duty police officer, this homicide detective, Christopher Sweeney, and this man, Robert Jones. But there was some reporting yesterday, late yesterday, from the Inquirer, citing some police sources saying that this man, Jones, was unarmed.
Okay.
And so that is a significant development in this unfolding case.
I have to say, I feel like I've seen this story before multiple times.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, the police, the first account often can change.
Right. There was an earlier account that perhaps this was an attempted carjacking.
Okay.
That was radioed in over the police radio. And that story seems to be disintegrating.
I see.
And so now we want to move to a very different story, Paige.
Oh, yeah. I like this one.
Town of New Hope. You know New Hope?
I do know New
Bucks
Hope.
County?
I do. Shout out New Hope.
Shout out New Hope. It's along the Delaware River. Up the Delaware River. Lovely town. You've been to New Hope?
I have been to New Hope once.
Uh-huh.
And it's lovely, like you said.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Quaint Main Street.
Quaint little shops, you know, little boutique hotels. Beautiful. There's something else there, I have to say. Spiders. There were
okay.
a lot of spiders when I went to New Hope.
Wait. So that's not what this story is about.
I know.
But just to explain real quick for folks, there's a lot of spiders in New Hope.
There's a lot of spiders, and maybe somebody from New Hope can write in and explain why you have this spider population you
How
seem
How many
to
spiders
have there.
Did you see?
I don't know. There was a bunch, man. There was a bunch of spiders. We have not been back to New Hope since the spider incident.
Well, I went to New Hope in May, didn't see a single spider.
Okay. Well, you're wrong. There you go.
Nor did I spot any celebrities.
Okay.
But apparently, celebs have been hanging around New Hope more and more and more. Interesting story in Philadelphia Magazine saying that New Hope, Pennsylvania is becoming like Aspen, Colorado East. There's lots of celebrities buying up property, spending time in New Hope because it is such a lovely place. Can I read some of the names?
Would love to hear it.
You know the Hadid family?
Of course.
They're models, right?
I know them personally.
No, you don't.
No, I don't.
Okay.
But I do. Yeah.
Is this what's going to be the whole hour?
It's going to be the whole hour. Just,
okay, you're just going to mess with me.
Got it.
And I usually do that to Cherry, so I think turnabout is fair play. So the Hadid family, you don't know them personally. They're very famous models, right? The daughters.
Famous models, both of them. The mother, too.
Jacob Dylan. Bob Dylan's son, also a great songwriter and singer in his own right, had that band The Wallflowers. He owns a place in New Hope now.
Okay.
You're not impressed by that? I mean, Jacob Dylan.
But Bradley Cooper.
And I was saving that one for last.
Okay. That's for last.
Bradley Cooper just bought a $6.5 million estate in the New Hope area. Also, Leonardo DiCaprio and Justin Bieber have been hanging around. Author James McBride has a place there. So this story by Philly Magazine kind of dives into why all of a sudden all of the celebs are super into New Hope. Do you get it? Do you see it as a place that attracts stars?
I mean, it's beautiful.
Yes.
It's low key. I think it's one of those towns people travel to because it's quaint and people
in between Philly and New York, too, which is key in this.
The
geography matters.
Right. I guess if these celebrities want to sort of get out of the spotlight, you can do a little escape to New Hope for the weekend. And now maybe that's not enough for them because they're buying these properties. I wonder how the people of New Hope feel about this.
So if you read the story in Philadelphia Magazine, they are they're ambivalent. They're torn in both directions. Look, the town was sort of down on its luck for a bit, and this has certainly revived it. Real estate values are through the roof. At the same time, it did also have like a quaint small town Gilmore Girls type of charm. And some people are worried that's being bulldozed to make it a playground for the rich. So by the way, if you live in New Hope, I think we have New Hope listeners.
We totally do.
We definitely have. I would be curious how you feel about this. I don't know if we'll have time to get it in today's show, but I am curious if people feel this push and pull in New Hope, because I was completely unaware that celebrities were spending oodles of time there.
So your question is, have you felt the push and pull?
Yeah.
Mine is, have you spotted Bradley Cooper on the corner?
Do you have his number? His email. Can we contact him?
Send that to
us. Will he come on Studio 2?
Or the Hadids. Either one. I'll take it.
But you would prefer?
I would prefer Bradley Cooper.
Just getting that out there. Okay, so let's transition now to our main topic today. We want to know about your decision to have or not have kids and what it's meant for your life. And that's because today, our big topic is the declining birth rate in this country. So give us a call, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org, and we will be right back.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
I'm still on the fence. When I was younger, I was confident that I wanted to have children. But as I age, I begin to reconsider that decision.
I go back and forth. I do think about it a lot. My current apprehensions mainly revolve around race and social justice. I'm afraid for my Black children.
I may want children because I want somebody to imbue my values and my morals into. So I don't know yet. I haven't decided.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Paige Marie Bessler in for Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. You just heard some voices from folks in our region who, like a lot of other people in this country, are ambivalent about having children. Birth rates in the U.S. have been trending down for nearly two decades, and the same thing is happening around the world. Getting married and having kids is no longer the default for adults, and women in particular.
And people have more choices than ever. Making the decision to have kids is a huge responsibility. We both know that, financially, morally. What are people weighing these days when they reach childbearing age? That's what we're wondering today. What exactly is contributing to the declining birth rate? We have two guests joining us this hour to navigate this topic.
And let me introduce them. Anastasia Berg is an assistant professor of philosophy at the University of California, Irvine, and co-author with Rachel Wiseman of What Are Children For? On Ambivalence and Choice. Anastasia Berg, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Catholic University economics professor Catherine Pakalik. She's the author of Hannah's Children, Women Quietly Defying the Birth Dearth. Catherine Pakalik, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you.
And to our audience, we're getting a little personal today. Tell us about your decision to have or not have kids and what that's meant for your life. You can email us right now. We have a bunch of emails already coming in, studio2@whyy.org, or give us a call. Our producers are standing by at the phones, 888-477-9499. Anastasia Berg, I want to start with you to sort of lay out this problem, if we're calling it a problem. The declining birth rate in this country, we're talking about the United States today, but like Avi said, it's happening all over the world. Just want to lay out exactly what is happening for our listeners.
So what we're seeing now is a combination of people having fewer children and increased rates of childlessness. And that is important because that suggests that people aren't just rethinking family size, but they're really rethinking whether or not they want to have children at all. And interestingly, it is a global phenomenon, like you said, but it's also a phenomenon that cuts in the U.S. locally across different social classes, across race lines. And in fact, working class people are showing faster rates of decline. They're still having more children, but the decline rates are even faster. And that's important to mention because sometimes people think this is a kind of elite phenomena or something that is true only of middle and upper middle classes.
Right. So that assumption that if you're getting highly formally educated, you're choosing to focus on a career, for example, and that you're maybe of a higher socioeconomic bracket, that this problem might be more specific to you. But what you're saying is, no, we're talking about pretty much everybody.
we're talking about everybody. It is something that is more pronounced, like is often the case with certain kind of cultural phenomena. There's a vanguard of the phenomena, but it's something that we see trickling to every part of society. Got for it. Sure.
And let me put a data point on this. In 1960, according to The Atlantic, American women had, on average, 3.6 children. That's 1960. In 2023, the total fertility rate was 1.62. I mean, that is a dramatic shift. And I want to read an email now from Juliet, who says, I've been thinking about this question a lot recently. I'm 27, and while I do think I want to have a kid, I don't think I ever will. My partner and I both work full time and can barely afford to support ourselves, so I don't see how I would ever afford a child. And second, the world is a mess, and I can't ethically support bringing a child into it. So, Catherine Bacalik, does that ring true? Does that sound familiar when Juliet says this is why I'm really on the fence and leaning maybe away from having kids? Is she giving reasons that lots of people tend to give?
Absolutely. I think that's really typical of what we're seeing in the data, in the broad social surveys and sort of one-on-one longer interviews. People are expressing, on the one hand, a sense that children are unaffordable in some deep way. And I think there's multiple ways to think about what it means that children are unaffordable in our lifestyles. And then the second thing is this like broad, just maybe deeper, maybe darker place. Like, is this a good time and place to bring a child into the world? So I think that's very representative.
And let me ask you about that last part, the idea that the world is simply not a sustainable place. I don't feel comfortable bringing a child into it. Why would that be popping up now? Because you could go back 100 years, 200 years, 300 years and find plenty of crises to worry about. Why is that sort of existential dread seem so heavy right now?
Well, I can only say my theory here is that this is, as you say, it's not that the world is necessarily a worse place. We've had our fair share over the last couple of centuries of really terrible things, but that somehow young people today are coming up, and I don't want to just put this on the young, without a certain array of spiritual resources, we would say, the kind of spiritual resources that give you courage to do something which is a risk, right? Because having a child is a risk.
Paige, should we bring in a caller now? Because I would love to hear from some folks out there.
I would too. So we have a caller on line 3, Charisse from West Philly. Charisse, you're on Studio 2. What is your question or comment?
My comment is that I am a 47-year-old Black woman in the area of Philadelphia, and at 38 is when I got baby fever. Thought, great, let me try to have a child, even though 38 is a little bit late. But by 40, I couldn't figure out why I couldn't conceive with my partner. And not until a few years later, and after going from, a few different doctors and hospitals, that it wasn't because I was too old and my eggs were old, but I actually have a fibroid. And it just never was diagnosed. And when it was diagnosed, they told me that it wasn't obstructing anything and it was fine, when really it was larger than needed to be, and it's actually taking up space in my uterus. So I couldn't actually, that's the reason why. But also, I think there should be more education for young women about not only their periods and their menstrual cycles when they're in grade school, but also not just how to prevent a pregnancy, but when you should start to have a pregnancy. Or, because we're not educated on our own bodies, and we don't even know about fibroids until we already have them. We don't know about eggs and how old they can get and how they're not viable for to grow. And it's just not fair that women are not taught, and young women are not taught about the full scape of their reproductive organs.
Thank you so much. That was Charisse from West Philadelphia. A lot to unpack there, Paige, but one thing I wanted to ask Anastasia Berg is Charisse brought up the idea that it basically took her a while to get to that decision point where she was ready to think about having a kid. And I would imagine we're seeing that population-wide, the sort of the child-bearing decision coming later in life. Is that true, Anastasia Berg? And what are the consequences of that when we talk about this broader issue?
Yeah, I mean, Charisse brought so many points that are so very important. And the first one, I really like the way you framed it, Avi. You said people are postponing thinking about having kids. Mm-hmm. So it's not just that people are postponing having children as if in the mid-20s they make a plan and decide to have them in their late 30s. What we're seeing is the creep of kind of a self-evident logic of postponement, when what we're postponing is so much as considering the question. So across different aspects of our lives, be it our professional lives, our romantic lives, our personal development, we are increasingly, when I say we, I mean millennials and Gen Zers, holding ourselves.
And I think we just lost Anastasia.
You're still considering the question of having.
We're having a little trouble with Anastasia Berg's
line.
Yes,
can you hear me?
Yeah, I'm just gonna actually shift over to Catherine Pakalik right now. Anastasia, mm-hmm. we're gonna get your line patched up. But Catherine, could you take the baton there from Anastasia?
Sure.
Because she was talking about this idea of we're talking about delaying that decision around childbearing and the ripple effects of that. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think, I think it's such a great point, and the way that you framed it is exactly right. There's a postponement of even thinking about when is the right time to have a child. But this other piece, right, when is the right time to have a child, it does something funny to us, right? Because once there's a right time, the right time can constantly move, right? The metric for when we're ready, the bar can be raised, and we're seeing that the bar is raising. So, you know, for instance, I follow Stephanie Murray's work in The Atlantic, which is, I think, really illuminating. And she's informed me that I just learned recently that many people feel that one separate bedroom for each child is like a necessary sort of status level. And I'm thinking, this is crazy. You know, on some level, you know, your kids actually aren't happier necessarily in their own separate bedrooms. But it's an example of how once you start asking what's the right time, well, then, you know, the right time can keep moving further into the future. That degree, that job, that trip. And, you know, we all know what it is to be, I guess I would say, young and a little short-sighted. We just think that the time horizon is kind of infinite.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like, you know, once I am a little more successful at my job and my house is big enough and I have enough of a support system around me of friends and family, and I know my partner and I are strong.
You can keep layering on more and more stuff.
And then you see online people talking about, oh, now I've solved my own mental issues and my own psychological issues so that I can be responsible enough to shape another human brain. Right?
Yes. It has this kind of, it lends itself to a ratcheting up effect, which is, of course, partially our own doing, but and then our peers too, right? So almost kind of a keeping up with the Joneses kind of ratcheting up, but, you know, not in a terrible way. I think people genuinely think, and may in fact in some cases be correct, that these are responsible, you know, mile markers to hit before you have a child, before you're ready.
Let me read in this email from Alexis, fascinating email. Alexis says, I am a 42-year-old woman. I do not have children, and I have always been nervous about the prospect of raising children in a society that expects more from women than men, especially when it comes to parenting. I've seen more women be single parents, and even if they are partnered with someone, they carry the weight. Beyond that, the U.S. is individualistic, and I would prefer a village community structure when creating a family. That's Alexis's perspective, and I think we have Anastasia Berg back. Anastasia, I would love to get your reflections on that email, because this is something that I have really felt as a parent. You know, we don't have kin networks here in Philadelphia, my family. So, you know, the burden is really on the two of us, me and my partner, and perhaps really more on her than me. Is that a big factor here? Geography, the fact that people don't live with their extended kin networks anymore?
So I think we want to separate the kind of things that loom very large in people's consciousness. And then we have to take into consideration the comparison to places where people do live closer by and whether or not the birth rates are affected. And what we find, like with other explanations we've heard from callers, so like a worry about affordability, for instance, that the worry about what we're hearing here, the distance from and lack of kinship relations, is that when we compare it to other countries where we do have grandparents nearby, more ready perhaps to assume those responsibilities when their kids have children, we don't see that directly affecting the birth rates.
So you're talking about other countries where people live in closer proximity to other generations of their family. Yeah.
That's right. So if we look at places like the Nordic countries, like Eastern European countries, we see that we don't have these great distances between people and their parents, especially, and yet people are still hesitant about having children and displaying birth rates that are as low or lower than the United States. That's not to say that I don't think that things like governmental, political, and economic measures to support children or better kinship relations wouldn't be wonderful, and it will allow people to raise their children in greater comfort and greater dignity. But whether or not it would affect the birth rates, that's another question.
Mm, yeah. Fascinating. That kind of punctured a myth for me, I guess. Go ahead, Paige.
Well, I think before we keep going in this conversation, I want to carve out a little space for something that came up earlier with our caller, which is fertility in this country. Mm-hmm. And we're talking a lot about choice today, but there are a lot of people in this country that want to have children and cannot. Anastasia Burr, can you talk a little bit about that piece of this?
Yeah, certainly. So I want to add to something that I think we heard from, was it Charisse who mentioned that she would like to see greater education, not just about how to not get pregnant, which is most of her sex ed today.
It's all about contraception in a sense, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's all about contraception. With a dash, we see more and more maybe thoughts about pleasure, about reciprocity, certainly about consent. But what we're not seeing are attempts to help people think about how to get pregnant. And that's not just a coincidence. Partly it's because talk about female fertility is increasingly being coded as something that is conservative and reactionary, as if merely talking about female biology is already putting pressure on women to have children. Mm. That's something that we have found in talking to hundreds of millennials and Gen Zers, mostly women, has really been doing a disservice to women. So Charisse's case is not exceptional. We see a lot of women believing that they can have children very easily into their late 30s, into their early 40s, and whatever they cannot do on their own, reproductive technology is there to jump in and save the day. One of the things we're not talking about are how unreliable reproductive technologies end up being, in particular egg freezing. So egg freezing is supposed to be the big savior, with a lot of women being encouraged a lot of times by the egg freezing companies to freeze their eggs as a way of empowering themselves, extending their fertility lines. The success rates for that technology are not high. Women do not know this, and then they come up against reality and experience a lot of disappointment. So one of our hopes for Rachel and myself is to break that connection between being honest and forthcoming about female fertility and this idea that this is somehow reactionary or this is somehow anti-women. If knowledge is power and the point of something like feminism is to empower women, then we want to put that knowledge in people's hands so that they could be making decisions in light of it and really being able to determine the shape of their own lives and making truly informed choices for themselves.
Yeah, and I really want to get Catherine Pakalik's take on that political piece that you talked about, this idea of conservative, pro-family values. We do have, you know, someone running for president that doesn't have any biological children, and she's talked about that a lot. And then, you know, our vice presidential candidate, J.D. Vance, has made some comments about childless people. And Catherine Pakalik, I want to get your thoughts here because you are, you know, openly talk about a little bit your political beliefs. You told me on the phone before that you're sort of a bad conservative a little bit. Can you talk about the political piece of this?
Yeah, that's great. I really super love Anastasia's point about how talking about fertility and this kind of information has become coded conservative. I think that's so true. And I'll try to separate your question. You know, the bad conservative in me is the person, in me who I think I'm, you know, deeply committed to the idea that kind of information is power, and that we want to live in a world and encourage and further a world where women are able to make decisions, that they own those decisions, and that they are able, empowered to make decisions that they can look back on and love, right? And love those decisions, whether it's to have children or not to have children, right? Or to have a small family or a big family. And so part of the reason for investigating the group of women that I investigated, women with especially large families, is to try to reveal the agency behind those choices. Mm. Because oftentimes those women are looked at as they don't think, they don't know what they're doing. Or, you know, like we've seen in some of the back and forth about the ballerina farm lady, like she must be the product of, you know, pressure.
This is a social media influencer for those who are not aware, and she has many children, right?
Yeah, and you know, this, you know, of course, there's lots of takes on that, but I mean, so I wanted to kind of get in there and find out, what was I going to find out? Was I going to find out that you know, basically people were feeling very, you know, pressured, and of course, I expected to hear stories of agency, but I wanted to know what that looked like. Mm. How exactly did their religious beliefs shape the choices that they made, right? So that's a whole, so, but that's, you know, in a sense, that's a story of choice, right? It's a whole story of what do you value and why do you choose it and what do you think it means afterwards? So in that sense, like if to be conservative today politically, right, is to be the kind of person who thinks we should kind of herd people into making life choices that we think are better, then I guess I'm a bad conservative, right? So I'm deeply pessimistic about these various government proposals.
Interventions,
which we've seen, all over the world, right? But they're coming to the United States now, right?
Yeah. I want to get into that in a second, actually, Catherine Pakalik, but I want to read this email because of the topic you were just speaking about. This is Andrew, who says, my wife and I are in our early 40s. We understand why other millennials and Gen Zers would be afraid to have kids. Global warming, exploding cost of living, the list goes on. But we have 6 kids. They help us see the joy in the world each day. And while some days it feels like we'll never have enough money, we have love. Children help us see a bright future. It was the best decision we've ever made. That's what Andrew says. Does that sound familiar, Catherine Pakalik? That sort of logic for making the choice, not just to have a kid or two, but to have many children.
Yeah. I heard many stories like that, and they were so interesting to me. They weren't things I would have guessed. Very encouraging. And really circling back to Anastasia's point, I found it interesting that just telling these stories, people have said, well, you're very bossy about how many children people should have. I said, no, like I just want the information to be out there. I want people to know that there are reasons and they're out there to be considered. But if you've never heard a reason like that, you know, you wouldn't know that it's available. Yep.
Right. And I also just sort of wanted to, I'll bring in an email actually right now. This is an email from Doug. He's 37. And although he's in a solid long-term relationship, he says he can't afford a kid. He said, I feel tricked into going to college. I'm now saddled with over $40,000 in college debt. So is my partner. My life feels barely stable enough. Rent and bills are everything I can afford. I can barely imagine a reality in which I could own land and a home. If you want to chime in like Doug, you can give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And again, right now we're talking about the declining birth rate in this country. Our guests are Anastasia Berg. She's an assistant professor of philosophy at UC Irvine and the co-author of What Are Children For? And Catherine Pakalik is an economics professor at Catholic University, and she's the author of Hannah's Children, Women Quietly Defying the Birth Dearth.
And we're about to hit a break, but Catherine Pakalik just alluded to something, this idea that government interventions may not be the solution. Now, we heard from Doug there saying, look, if I had some more money, I'd be happy to have kids. Mm-hmm. But there is some research that suggests writ large, not discrediting Doug's personal experience, but writ large, that might not actually play out. Giving people child tax credits, incentivizing fertility in different ways might not actually unlock a completely different birth rate. So we're going to get into that after the break. But let me give out the number one more time. 888 888- 877-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. And we're getting personal stories this hour on Studio 2 for why people decided to have or not have kids. Let me read one more here. Amber says, life made the decision for me. I didn't want to have children with someone who I was not married to. I was married and got pregnant several times, but unfortunately did not carry them to term. My marriage ended. I haven't remarried. I've always wanted to foster or adopt, and I began exploring that in process last year. Amber, thank you so much for that comment and for your perspective. We want to hear more. Studio2@whyy.org or 888-477-9499.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
A lot of my peers are like getting married and or have kids right now, but I'm still in school. It's always been a goal of mine to start a family and like get actually serious, like once I'm finished with school and have a job.
It's not something that I really like have the funds to do with IVF, and it's not really something that like I or my partner want to do, so yeah.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Paige Marie Bessler in for Cherry Gregg. We just heard some more voices related to today's topic about the declining birth rate. We have two guests with us in the studio, both experts, both wrote books on this topic. Anastasia Berg, assistant professor of philosophy at UC Irvine, co-author of What Are Children For? And Catherine Pakalik, she's an economics professor at Catholic University, and she wrote Hannah's Children, Women Quietly Defying the Birth Dearth.
And I love that phrase, birth dearth.
I do too.
Really rolls off the tongue. Email studio2 at whyy.org with your comments, or give us a call, 888-477-9499. And before the break, I talked about this idea, and we're seeing it in a lot of comments, that perhaps it's really just about money. It's about financial security. And we have a caller on line one. This is Niware from Lehigh Valley, who wants to talk about the economy and kids. First of all, did I get your name right?
It's Nevaeh.
Nevaeh from the Lehigh Valley. I'm sorry about that.
Yes, sir. No problem.
So you wanted to talk about the economy and kids. Go ahead.
Yes. I have always dreamed of having my own family since I was a young child. And one of the things that has actually prevented me is that the U.S. economy isn't set up for me to raise my own children. You know, the average maternity leave is 6 weeks, if that even. And it, frankly, takes a lot longer than that to raise kids. So I'm not interested in paying somebody else to do the job. If I can't do it, I'm not having kids.
That's fascinating. And I really felt in many ways the same way Nevaeh does. Anastasia Berg, I'm sure you hear that as a rationale from a lot of people. What does the research say about sort of the intersection between, you know, these policies like child leave, parental leave, child tax credits, and birth rates?
So the economy and the threat that children are unaffordable certainly looms very large in the minds of Americans, also people in the UK. However, when we look at countries where these kinds of obstacles to having children have been lifted, so if you look at the Nordic countries, places with ample parental leaves for mothers and fathers, with free universal health care, with free child care, we see that the birth rates are either as low as they are in the U.S. or even lower. Now, that is not, for me, an argument against those policies. I think those policies are important. But it does suggest that as measures for increasing the birth rate and as explanations for why people are not having children, they can only tell a part of the story, if at all. And I would like to add that what we see is, and this is also a global phenomena, is that people, in trying to explain what I think is very deep-seated ambivalence, they will often reach for explanations explanations that will make their choice intelligible, not just to others, but to themselves. Sometimes even make it seem like the ethically right choice. So we've heard during this past half hour, we've heard people talk about the economy, we've heard people talk about social justice, we've heard people talk about climate change.
And we
can talk more about that as well. But I think that what we see is that sort of a testament to just how fraught that question is, to just how unclear it is for people, even internally, what really is motivating their choices, that we have this attempt to reach for explanations. And because of that structure, because of the fact that when we look at one explanation, we see that places where that explanation does not hold, the same kind of ambivalence is still present that makes us doubt that it ultimately is the final explanation.
Well, let me offer a hypothesis. And Catherine Pakalik, you're going to tell me I'm wrong, I'm sure. But is it possible that the size of these interventions is simply not large enough, that the cultural tides are so strong in the other direction that these policies, while they may work, they're just a drop in the bucket, and so they don't really sort of show up in these larger population size data points? What do you think about that, Catherine Pakalik?
Well, so in a sense, you're right? So I think people do respond to incentives. And what I mean by that is they're weighing the cost of the benefits of what's in front of them, the choice in front of them. But the problem is, I think that let's just put it bluntly, the size of the kind of intervention that you would need to have that might move the needle. Some people have estimated $300,000 per child. Would that move the needle? Would $500,000 per child move the needle? Well, it probably would look pretty different from these $6,000 baby bonuses and child tax credits, Because those are really staggering big numbers. But yet it's irrelevant because there's no country on earth that can afford numbers like that. And it would be a kind of bootstrapping where you'd hope that you could just, borrow from the future and spend enough money to lift the rate enough that then, you could pay it back in the next generation. Nobody thinks that's feasible. So, kind of what I found is that, maybe to Anastasia's point, I think there are deeper things going on that kind of there aren't enough, people don't have enough reason to tip the scales. But what they're trying to tip the scales against is a kind of an encounter with a lot of difficulties. But I don't think that they're best captured in the economics. Who wants to start waking up in the morning, in the middle of the night 10 times? And to the caller's point, I completely agree with her. Who wants to have a baby and then think you're not going to have to have somebody else raise your baby?
Yeah.
I think those are real. Is there a number you can pay somebody to overcome that difficulty? If there is, it's a fantastical number.
Yeah,
so.
We have not hit that hypothetical number yet.
Yeah, and I will say, Catherine, you talked to so many women for your book about their decision to have, large families. And when I personally, when I was thinking about just having one child, I don't think there's any sort of government incentive that would have swayed me. I would spend time Googling, should I have a baby? And there's really no one answer. There's no answer for somebody. What we're really talking about is this individual, deeply personal, ethical, moral decision. No matter how much we talk about the economy and climate change and politics, and it just comes down to what it is that's right for you. Is that right?
Yeah. I kind of want to underscore, I think the way that this conversation often ends up sounding to people, when I say the kinds of things I say, or when we hear Anastasia talk about the kinds of things she's saying, it sounds to people like you're saying, well, don't do anything nice for families. And of course, it's not what I believe. And I think there are probably, many, many things that countries can do to honor and, dignify the sacrifices parents make and maybe things like that. But will they raise the birth rate? Will they cause people to want to have a baby that don't want to have one now? We don't think so. It's like the history of kind of these pronatal incentives across countries, and really over time, outside of the United States, these have been tried around the world for more than 40 years. We don't think they'll move the needle. So the real question is, why don't they move the needle? That's what we're trying to dig into. And I think both of these books really speak to that question.
Let me read this email from Jessica. This is fascinating. Jessica says, I'm 29 and my husband and I have one beautiful baby girl. I feel like a bit of a black sheep in the conversation. I belong to two communities that have very divergent views. I'm an Orthodox Christian in a community where the vast majority of women have 3, 4, 5 children and don't work. On the other hand, I work full-time at a landscape architecture firm where I'm the only woman in her 30s who has a child and sees this as a beautiful thing. My husband and I hope to have 3 or 4 children, but it's hard to sort through these decisions when I'm so different than the women around me. Mm. Anastasia Berg, that last phrase there, I'm so different than the women around me. It does feel like for a lot of people, making that decision to have children puts them out of sync with their peer group. Do you think that is a primary or secondary cause of declining birth rates? Where do you see that fitting in the conversation?
I think that's definitely part of the kind of force that's contributing to what I was calling the self-evidence of a logic of postponement. We have a close friend who had kids in her early 30s, and she would describe feeling like a child bride. And a teen mom. So this is how she would describe herself for the choice to have a child, and to get married and to have a child. And so what we see is in increasingly many circles, so professional circles, certainly in places like academia, culturally vanguardish kind of places, we see the logic of postponement at play. And then the choice to have children becomes that much more difficult because exactly like you were saying, it will put you out of sync with others. And it's important to realize that as the rates of childlessness will increase, the size of those spaces will increase as well. So as children become rarer in our society, the harder it is for people who are even leaning yes to embrace that choice. And so I think it's really important, you know, Catherine really said correctly that people hear her or myself speak and they think we're somehow against the kind of measures that might help people raise their children with honor and with dignity. But I would say something more. I think for people who think those measures are important, which is at least most of the times liberals and progressives, the possibility of embracing the role of children in our lives and embracing kind of full-heartedly the possibility of a robust human future, because that really is what's at stake when we're talking about whether or not to have kids, that's something that is at the basis of a call for those kind of measures. If you want to have measures that support families, you have to be able to embrace the possibility of children. And right now we're having that kind of disconnect. We're having much more of ambivalence on the left about families and children, mm-hmm. while still trying to call for the kind of policies that would support them. And I think that can be make those policies much harder to justify.
Fascinating. We have a caller on line 6, Karen from Mount Airy. Karen has 2 millennial kids. And Karen, you're on Studio 2. What is your comment?
Yeah, hi. Thank you very much. I'm really enjoying your conversation. Both of my kids, one's 36, my daughter, and my son is 33. And they're both on the fence for sure about having any children. And their reasons are really financial. My son has $90,000 in school loans, and as with a bachelor's degree, he's only making, he can barely afford a place to live. And he would love to have children, but he really feels that he can't right now. They're concerned about the climate. They're concerned about politics and the way the world's going. And my daughter, who's 36, has decided, I do check in with her because of her age. And my daughter has basically decided that she's going to be an animal mom and take care of animals. And both of them, you know, I support them 100%. Mm. I realize it's not the same decision that I made when I had my 2 and my mom had 4. I'm right with the percentages that you stated.
It's the perfect sort of anecdote to to show how things have changed. That's Karen in Mount Airy. Thank you so much for that comment. So we are wrapping up here. So but real quick, Catherine Bacalik, because we didn't really get into sort of solutions. And I think we're just going to have to put that conversation off for another day. But it feels like at the heart of this, Catherine, is choice. That in many prior generations, people either didn't have a choice or didn't feel they had a choice around whether or not to have kids. Clearly, it seems people feel more empowered to choose now. Is that the basic change, or has something else changed that I'm missing?
I think so. I mean, I think that children are, like, I guess the way I think about it is they're opt-in.
Yes.
You have to opt into having children. You won't grow up and, you know, biologically, relationally, you won't accidentally have children today, and you won't be expected to have children today. So yeah, it's opt-in. And I think when something that seems like we could take it for granted for so long, right? We took it for granted so much
that
people really worried about there being too many children.
Right. Mm.
And I think
overpopulation.
I think social, social imagination, the imagination of society, kind of it's got lags to it. It has to catch up. And we've taken for granted that there was a natural propensity to have children. But I think we're seeing that there isn't. And so when it comes to a question of choice, it is a question of choice. I think it
ought to be. That's a paradigm shift. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think people should have children by accident or without knowledge or without choosing. But then, in fact, the whole interesting question is, what are the arguments? Like, what are the reasons?
Well, we have to save it for another day.
Interesting.
It is fascinating.
Yes, of course.
I wish we had more time. And can I just say, great guest today, but also just phenomenal emails. And I'm so sorry we didn't get to you. David and Patricia and John and Mary and Gloria and Erica and Beth and Ellen. I mean, the list goes on. Just amazing. People really opened up today on Studio 2, and I want to commend them for that. You made this show so much richer. Catherine Pakalik, you also helped quite a bit in that regard. Economics professor at Catholic University and author of Hannah's Children, Women Quietly Defying the Birth Dearth. Thank you, Catherine, for your time today.
Welcome.
And Anastasia Berg, assistant professor of philosophy at UC Irvine and co-author of What Are Children For? Thank you so much for your perspective, Anastasia.
Thank you for having me and for giving me a chance to talk to Catherine.
And Studio 2 is produced, should I say this?
Yeah,
Debbie Gilder,
Paige
Murray Bessler, and Andreas Cope. Al Banks is our engineer. Our executive producer is Kevin McCoury. Our youth correspondents today were Emily Hildenbrand and Donna Al-Zalam. This is Avi Wolf-Manarit. I'm Paige Murray Bessler. We will talk to you tomorrow.
See ya.